Welcome to the Library of Mistakes, changing the world one mistake at a time.
I'm Russell Napier, the keeper of the library, a beautifully designed building in Edinburgh, housing more than 4,000 books about the mistakes that the world keeps repeating, particularly in finance and business. Visit libraryofmistakes.com to find out more. And for those keen to guard against mistakes, we also run a course called A Practical History of Financial Markets, available both in person in London and Edinburgh, or online for wherever you are in the world. To find out more about the course, please see the link in the podcast show notes. Well, hello everyone, and welcome to this podcast with Mark Higgins, author of a new book, Investing in US Financial History, Understanding the Past to Forecast the Future. Mark, hello.
Hello, and thank you so much for having me on, Russell. I am especially excited for this podcast. You are quite the historian yourself, and I'm just really excited for the discussion. Thank you for having me.
First of all, I want to thank you. You've done the world of financial history a great service by writing this book. I'm often asked, where should I go to get an overview? And I always say, well, if you're looking for financial history with a focus on the stock market, actually, I can't really point you to any book that will give you a decent overview of this interaction between the economy, money, credit, and securities prices. And then you've done it. So you've now written it. So I can now say, yeah, read Mark Higgins if you want to get this great overview.
Thank you.
And then as we were discussing earlier, there may be specific incidents you want to get a lot more detail in, but this is going to give you the best overview, point you in the right direction, which makes it a very difficult book to talk about because you're covering the whole of US financial history. I read it at one sitting, 522 pages on a long flight. That's how engrossed I was by it. But let's pick a few of these. Pick maybe a few of the more obscure ones that people don't know and some of the lessons that came from that. And I do stress we will be scraping the surface here. Alexander Hamilton is not the flavor of the month, flavor of the decade, I think. And he cropped up quite a lot in your book, even in later chapters, because of his rather perspicacious quotations. But let's get to the one that he was most involved with, the crisis of 1792, because you argue in this book that he was ahead of Walter Badgett in terms of what he did and how he tried to fix it. That would be the first financial crisis involving a financial markets for the United States, or certainly for the equity market. So maybe you can talk us through 1792 as a place to start with America's introduction to the world of boom and bust. And any parallels? And I think what your book shows is certain repeating patterns through history on these. So tell us about 1792 and what you learned through.
Yeah, so at a high level, first of all, securities markets were a lot different back then in that there weren't many securities being traded. But, you know, essentially what happened in 1792 was the First Bank of the United States, which was the first real central bank. Now, it wasn't exactly the same in terms of scope of responsibilities, but it was the nation's first central bank, was launched in 1791 by Alexander Hamilton. It was chartered in 1791. And basically some government debt was trading on Wall Street, and stock in the bank of the First Bank of the United States, which was the U.S. Central Bank, and then another stock in the Bank of New York. And you had this character named William Dewar, who he basically got a group together and was trying to corner stock in the Bank of New York, and also attempting to corner the market for some of the bonds that were trading in New York at the time. And it was not developed in terms of how a central bank should respond, or in this case, it was actually really the Treasury, should respond to intervene in markets when there's a mania or when there's a crash. And Alexander Hamilton really showed, after the corner was essentially broken and the market started to collapse, there could have been a collapse of the financial system. And Alexander Hamilton really showed that he had some central banking abilities that were way ahead of his time in terms of making sure that the market was supported and didn't kind of go into a spiral downward in terms of a deflationary spiral, and worked with people at the Bank of New York to stem the crisis. And it was really, what was amazing about it is some of the principles of essentially stopping a panic before it spirals out of control were exhibited by Hamilton well before people really even knew that that was the role of a central bank, or in this case, it was sort of the treasury at this point, but he was basically taking on central banking responsibilities.
It looks like he learned this from reading books. That's the message we like here at the Library of Mistakes, that Alexander Hamilton had learned a lot just by watching, as Yogi Berra might say.
Yeah, exactly. And it's interesting to see there are some quotes in that chapter where it's actually taken from documents, from letters, where he articulates the principle of a central bank, which is essentially to be the lender of last resort, and do it at a higher rate to kind of not punish too hard, but kind of provide an incentive for banks not to get in trouble. And he really articulated that principle in a letter that was all the way back in 1792.
Yeah, so there's lots of interesting things in this book, but there's a theme that runs through it of fraud, corruption, malfeasance. Running through the whole thing. And then government interaction. So I think many people might think, if they read a book on financial history, that these two things would play a small role. But in the history of the United States, they've actually played quite a big role. We're going to jump forward to 1837, when the actions of the President Andrew Jackson play quite a major role in the next crisis.
Yeah.
But this crisis, and this is the thing that comes out of your book, this may have been the biggest crisis America's ever had. It may well be worse than the 1930s. And I just wanted, there's a lovely quote that you find here from someone called the Reverend Sidney Smith, British investor in Pennsylvania bonds. And now this is written in 1844, but he explains where America was in 1844. People can judge for themselves if this is worse than where it was in 1934. He makes the following comments. Yep. Now the Americans have cut themselves off from all resources of credit, having been as dishonest as they can be. They are prevented from being as foolish as they wish to be. In the whole habitable globe, they cannot borrow a guinea, and they cannot draw the sword because they have no money to buy it. Wow.
That's right.
Wow.
So yeah, and about this, I'm sure you can appreciate it, especially being in the UK, but the Panic of 1837, which really extended over several years, was, if you rewind before that, Andrew Jackson essentially killed the Second Bank of the United States, which was the second iteration of a central bank in the United States. And after that happened, state banks just kind of proliferated throughout the country and lent irresponsibly to a lot of real estate investors in kind of the Midwest. And there's a whole series of events that were actually international that kind of caused a crash in the United States. And what happened is, we worry about the federal government has technically never defaulted in the United States, but states got way over their ski tips, and actually 8 states defaulted on their debt. 1 territory, which is now a state, Florida, defaulted on their debt in the early 1840s. Which, again, it wasn't a federal default, but, most people think there's no precedent really for defaulting on their debt. There is, absolutely, at the state level. And that was the quote that you referenced there was referring to the fact that a lot of British investors had invested in state issued debt and it defaulted. Now, some of it was paid back eventually. Some of it never was.
Yeah, I don't know if you know this, but in A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens, when Scrooge wakes up, I think it's after his second visitation, one of his nightmares has been that his portfolio consists of mere American securities.
So, I did not know that. But, the funny thing is, I don't know if you remember, there was a Charles Dickens quote in the book. When he visited the United States, he kind of saw this empty building, and it was the old building of the Second Bank of the United States.
Yeah, so we're already into the other thing that's running through this, which is a long time to work out what money is. Now, I wouldn't say that was necessarily just an American phenomenon, but to the extent that there would be paper money, to the extent that gold would be money, to the extent that silver would be money. And they seem to these major debates about what is money seem to coincide with some of the major turning points in U.S. history. We're going to come back to bimetallicism or gold and silver later on. We're moving rapidly forward into the age of the railways. Let me read you another quote from this time Arthur T. Hadley, who you quote in this book as of 1886, because this feeds in, I think, into America's relationship with foreign investors as well. But also it's maybe tells us a little bit about the cycle more generally. And he said this in 1886, What has been true of railroads has been true of other forms of permanent investment. First, high charges and high profits. Then, speculative investment in the same line. Next, an overstocked market and no profit at all. Finally, cutthroat competition and widespread insolvency. That kind of seemed impossible. The US was such a huge landmass, really only opened up after the Civil War. It seemed impossible to overinvest in railroads, but America managed it. Maybe you could talk us through how on earth, with a current account deficit and very limited savings, managed to overinvest in such a grand scale.
Yeah, I mean, it was sort of a tragedy for foreign investors. So there was this cycle that happened with canals, and it happened, you know, on several occasions with railroads, where you would have massive, I mean, from the perspective of Europe, the United States was an attractive, very attractive emerging market. And in the 1800s, most of the United States was not generating its own capital to invest. It was getting capital from Europe, a lot of it coming from the UK. And there would be, you know, massive investment because there was a lot of excitement about this emerging market and all the potential. There was a lot of fraud going on in terms of the people that were raising capital for railroads. And then once it was raised, you know, how it got siphoned out of the companies, which I go into a lot in one of the chapters. And it was this, there's a quote, I don't have it exactly, but there's this kind of call out box called the foreign capital cycle, where you would get this foreign capital investment kind of along the lines of that quote that you just read. The United States, you know, the companies would overbuild. There would be a crash, and then the securities would decline in value. And Americans had kind of have an advantage. They knew which securities were actually worth something, which ones weren't, and they would buy them up. So you essentially had the situation where foreign capital funded the development of infrastructure in the United States. Then after the crash, Americans bought up the securities for pennies on the dollars and owned the infrastructure too. It was kind of an irony of history. And my guess is, I actually don't know too much of what's going on in China and elsewhere in the world, but my guess is that's repeating elsewhere, where you have kind of a local advantage in raising capital and kind of knowing where the good spots are. And then when there's a crash, they buy it up. So my guess is that's repeating somewhere in the world today.
Yeah, it's certainly been my experience as an emerging market investor that the locals got a much better steer on true value than the foreigners do. And certainly during the Asian financial crisis, the locals were moving a lot of money out of the country as the foreigners were coming in. And they did get some bargains when things had bottomed. This feeds into a little bit of Scottish history as well, because we set up investment trusts here to invest in US securities. And there was one man in particular called Robert Fleming from Dundee, who spent a lot of time traveling to the US. And he seemed to be behaving more like a local. He seemed to have some real understanding of intrinsic value. But the others were sheep for fleecing, I think. And you point out that for most of America's history, foreigners... that's exactly what foreign investors were, and for most of it, really up until perhaps all the way up to the 1930s.
And then to your point, like that, you go through the cycle, and it, you know, it's kind of like that 20 to 30 year cycle where you start with the excitement and end with the crash. And you would think that there'd never be any investment again, but you know, people forget, and in 10 to 20 years, the cycle starts again, and it's just kind of repeats throughout history. Now, American markets, particularly in the 1930s, did develop a level of integrity that they were lacking in the 1800s. But, you know, there's still some of that phenomenon today.
Yeah, I think we're definitely going to get to the 1930s and this transformation with the legislation of the 1930s. As well as being useful for understanding the US market, I think some of this is useful for understanding emerging markets. As we kind of discussed, this was the big emerging market. Just on the railroads, could you say a bit more about the Union Pacific? Give us a list of ways that the board of the Union Pacific fleeced its shareholders to their own personal advantage. So we're ready next time it happens.
Yeah, and this is endemic. I actually shortened this chapter a bit. I used to have it as just nine different ways that railroads would fleece people. And it's kind of like in the 1800s, there were just very few securities regulations in the 1800s. And railroads were by far the biggest companies in terms of capitalization during the late 1800s. And there were just so many ways. What's really ironic, and I talk about this in one of the chapters, is most people think of trusts and large companies when they create kind of a monopolistic power in the market, that really the purpose is to fleece people to, you know, because they have pricing power. But that really wasn't the big way that a lot of these railroads were, you know, fleecing people. There were, one of the most common ways that railroads would take advantage of, you know, take advantage of investors really, is these construction and finance companies. And the way this would work is the company would be capitalized to build a road, and a small subset of owners or management would establish a separate construction and finance company. And the construction and finance company would contract to build the railroad and would just completely overcharge the investors in the actual railroad. And to the point that I think of the Union Pacific, I don't remember the actual amount, but for a couple of years, they were paying 100% dividends. And then there was political corruption as well. A lot of these owners of the construction and finance company, who were also, you know, on the railroad as well, would use shares in construction and finance companies to bribe politicians. And there was a big scandal. The one you're referencing, the Union Pacific, the Credit Mobilier scandal, was the construction and finance company for the Union Pacific. And that got exposed in the early 1870s and really kind of led to some cut down on those types of scandals.
Yeah, so I've certainly seen this in emerging markets. And I would suggest anybody investing in an emerging market in the listed vehicle does check to see whether the family that owns a listed vehicle has any other vehicles and whether they are engaged in any form of business with the listed company. It's much more prevalent than you think, and often not in the analyst notes or the analyst research.
That's interesting. Yeah, I mean, I would expect these. I mean, that's an easy way. The funny thing about some of these railroads is, again, people think of once the railroads got really big and they had monopolistic power, that the purpose was to fleece customers. But the reality is that was more of a defense. There were such vicious price wars that really consolidating was more of a defensive position than it was an offensive position. But in the early stages of development of railroads, that's where the real, the real fleecing of people happened. Another one that was highlighted in the book is bribery. So what railroads would often do, and the big culprit, the worst actor here was probably the Central Pacific, which was owned by four gentlemen called the Associates. One of them is Stanford University is named after Leland Stanford. And what they would do is there was a lot of money to be made if you had land near a station that or a stop that was going to be built on the railroad. And there was just regular, essentially blackmailing of leaders of villages and cities that, look, if you pay us a certain amount, we're going to put a station there, and they would pay it. It was basically blackmail.
Okay, well, people investing in emerging market infrastructure, you have been warned. At least these are some things you should be looking out for. The great 19th century debate, I mean, it's interesting how America works out what money is. Was it free banking, banks able to make money up by themselves, chartered banks which had to be backed by bonds? And then after the Civil War, we have this issue with going back onto the gold standard. Farmers really demanding easier money because they were in debt, but the price of their products were falling. Not a pleasant place for anybody to be. So to somewhat succeeding in terms of increasing the supply of money, they thought, by bringing in silver, but it really backfired, didn't it? And really a little bit of Gresham's Law got underway, and the attempt to get some easy money actually got tighter money. And we had the Panic of 1893. So for those who don't understand this relationship between gold and silver and why it didn't deliver what the farmers, basically the farmers and William Jennings Bryan, hoped it would deliver, can you explain how this made things worse rather than better?
So what's interesting, you know, we're worried about inflation right now. During the 1800s, there was a lot of worry about deflation, particularly in the late 1800s. And the reason that the farmers with the leadership of William Jennings Bryan, who led the free silver movement, the borrowers are hurt by deflation, right? I mean, their debt is denominated, that doesn't go down, but their pricing power is affected. So what happened with the free silver is there are a couple of acts in Congress that were designed to kind of stoke inflation or at least stop deflation. And what would happen is the Treasury would issue notes and buy silver from silver miners. But the notes could be redeemed for either gold or silver. And the problem was the ratio of gold to silver didn't change with the production of silver. And there was massive production of silver. So this is the Gresham's Law, which you referenced. What would happen is it was obviously advantageous to take notes that were basically, you know, bought with silver and redeem them for gold. And that led to a drain of gold in the reserves of the United States. And it reached a crisis point in 1893. And the real, and what happened was J. Pierpont Morgan, there was some intervention from the Treasury, but J. Pierpont Morgan also organized a loan and acquired gold to kind of refill the Treasury in the United States. And it stopped the, now it didn't totally stop the crisis, but it at least stopped the reserves of the United States really going down to zero. And then with the election of 1896, the free silver movement died when William Jennings Bryan lost the election. But what was really important about that story and why I wanted to include it in the book, so first of all, it was an important episode in U.S. history, the free silver movement. But second of all, that was the moment that really led to the rise of J. Pierpont Morgan as the de facto leader of Wall Street and really the conscience of Wall Street, which had a major effect in the at the turn of the 20th century, particularly at the Panic of 1907.
Yeah, so we're now living in a world where America doesn't have a central bank, and J.P. Morgan has to step into that position.
Yep.
That Gresham's Law was more likely to happen in a world where everybody else was on the gold standard. So, you know, you could,
yep,
there was a certain amount of arbitrage opportunity, which may not be quite so much there in the fiat currency system we have before, but it was a good example in a world of hard money, how even the smallest attempt to have a little bit of a softer money with silver in it really, yep, really backfired for the farmers and for everybody else.
Yeah,
there is a transition which people forget, I think, when they think of U.S. financial history, but you really flag it up. This transition from America as a country with a current account deficit to America, mm-hmm, as a country with a current account surplus. Turns out, yeah, in the whole scheme of American history, that was quite a brief period in the whole scheme of things, because it kind of ends in the late 1960s. But let's talk about that period. And I just wanted to read from the book to put this in context. During the nation's first 110 years, businesses relied heavily on foreign capital to fund businesses, government projects, and federal and state debt. The American commercial invasion, which is basically its export boom of the late 19th century, tipped the scales in the other direction. In 1902, the U.S. had accumulated nearly $2.5 billion in trade surpluses. The money was used initially to buy back securities held by Europeans. Van der Lippe recalled touring a bank vault in Germany that had several empty shelves. His host explained that the shelves were filled with U.S. securities that had since been repurchased by America.
Yeah.
So that's an important change for America, no longer reliant upon the kindness of strangers, massively exacerbated, of course, by World War One. What difference do you think it made for the securities markets when you go from running a current account deficit to now running a pretty permanent and obviously during the war exceptionally large current account surplus?
Well, it was one interesting thing is that American investors now had money to invest in their own securities. But, you know, backing up to the American commercial invasion, it was one of the more interesting discoveries as I've never heard that talked about. And Frank van der Lippe, he was a famous financier in the early 1900s. And he has this obscure book that's called The American Commercial Invasion of Europe. And from the perspective of Europeans, it seemed to come out of nowhere. But if you look back over the last 50 years, I mean, there's a lot of shenanigans in the United States over the last 50 years of the 1800s, but it was kind of like the American commercial invasion was the culmination of a lot of our competitive advantages just coming to fruition at the same time. And, you know, one of them, it seems like a not important thing, but what was really interesting in the United States, as opposed to the rest of the world, which allowed us to become such a manufacturing powerhouse, is we had a lot of innovations on precision manufacturing and producing replaceable parts, interchangeable parts, which seems, you know, doesn't seem that special today, but it was actually a really big deal. And that was what enabled us to mass produce at, you know, low cost relative to the and high quality relative to the rest of the world. And that was very critical to our export boom that we saw during the American commercial invasion. Another thing was just our natural resources. We continue to have tremendous natural resources in the United States. There was a discovery of silver in the Comstock Lode in Nevada. There was the gold discovery in the late 1800s at Sutter's Mill. And there was oil at Titusville. in Pennsylvania, and then there was great iron reserves in the upper Midwest, like Minnesota or Michigan, I forget which ones, but it was the Mesabi, the iron mine. So there's more to it there, but the American commercial invasion was a very monumental inflection point for the United States. And yes, the way it influenced securities markets is, I think at some point, we started targeting our own in terms of fleecing people, whereas in the past we had done it to Europe. But that was a really monumental inflection point for the United States.
Yeah, it seems that we always call Australia the lucky country, but it seems just when America needs more resources, it kind of gets them, whether it's 1848, whether it's the Yukon, both of these obviously affecting the supply of money.
And that was a goal too, yeah.
And now, obviously, with fracking, which is quite an old story now, but that's transformed the American energy situation as well. Just when you think American resources, there are no more rabbits to pull out of the hat, seemingly another rabbit comes out of it. I wanted to read something. We're still, throughout this monetary instability is something that's fascinating to me. And it comes again in the 20s with the attempt to reconstitute the global gold standard, which is not a great success. But you've got a wonderful quote here from Benjamin Strong explaining the dilemma that the Federal Reserve was in. So Benjamin Strong was the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. And this is what he says. I think it's fascinating in relation to where the Federal Reserve is today as well. I earnestly believe that so he's writing in 1926, I earnestly believe that the greatest service that the Federal Reserve System is capable of performing today in this matter is to hasten, so far as it has the power wisely and without undue hazard, this question of monetary reform in the countries that have suffered from the war. So the idea is the Federal Reserve is looking at the domestic U.S. economy, looking at price stability, is that phrase we'd use today. But the Fed's also looking wider and way back into the 1920s. And of course, the allegation is that Strong and then Strong died, but the rest of the Federal Reserve kept interest rates too low in the 20s because they had this eye on trying to help everybody else reconstruct the global monetary system. So there are lots of different theories on this. You're spent a lot of time looking at this. What's your view? Was that a key part of why things got out of control in the 20s?
Yeah, I mean, there are two elements of the Great Depression, though. It does. So what was happening is the Fed was getting concerned about speculation and in the late 1920s. And if they raised rates, it would pull gold out of Europe, essentially. And that would force them to tighten, and that would impact Reconstruction during World War I. So Ben Strong was essentially trying to support the European Reconstruction efforts, which was also U.S. policy at the time. So that certainly did lead to more speculation on Wall Street. And we all know how that ended in October 1929 with the Great Crash. But the Great Depression, that was an important driver, initial driver of the Depression in the 1930s. But if you look at what really allowed it to deepen and go for so long, it was really flawed fiscal and monetary policy that was under Hoover, and it started to reverse under Roosevelt, was really geared on austerity. And the greatest mistake that the Federal Reserve made was not stepping into help the banking system when banks started to collapse. So you had a massive collapse of the banking system. So yeah, what Strong said in terms of shaping monetary policy to support Europe certainly contributed to the speculation in the late 1920s. But there's a lot of evidence that the Great Crash of 1929 is very much overplayed. And I agree with that the Depression was so deep and so long because of monetary and fiscal policy, not just as a result of that crash.
Yeah, well, I think the Fed have effectively said mea culpa. There's this incredible speech by Ben Bernanke at Milton Friedman's 90th birthday. Anna and Milton, you were right. It was our fault and will never happen again. Well, the fact that they've let it happen again says a lot about where securities markets are today, actually. And that's one of the reasons I brought it up, is this great contrast with views on money in the past, restrictions on gold, restrictions on bank issuance, the bonds, silver, gold. There was always some restriction, but it seems that one of the lessons of the 1930s is let's not be at least so restricted that we have been in the past with monetary policy.
Yeah, and so it's kind of like there are two poles in the United States in terms of the Federal Reserve's mistakes, both having really to do with price stability, I guess. So the big mistake in the 1930s was allowing the Depression to go too far. And I talk about this in the book. We don't talk about it now, but the real risk of major depressions is not how much money you lose, it's how many lives you lose. And if you look at World War II, I would argue that the Great Depression is really what caused it. Hitler was really on his last legs in 1928. I talk about this in the book. But once the Depression hit and affected Germany, much worse than the United States, his toxic ideology became more popular because desperate people do desperate things. So that was one pole of the mistakes. And we avoided doing the same thing during the global financial crisis. Now, the other pole is the great inflation that happened from 1965 to 1982. And you can kind of see why it happened. The Fed would, and you can see it in, we'll talk about it, how it applies today, but one of the big mistakes in the great inflation is the Federal Reserve kind of chickened out and abandoned monetary tightening prematurely. And every time they did that, inflation ticked up to a higher level and it became harder to contain. And you can kind of understand why they did it, because people were so spooked about unemployment because they remembered the Great Depression and World War II. But those are the two big mistakes that the Fed has made. And I hope, and all signs are that this is true, at least from what I've seen, the Federal Reserve has learned from both of those mistakes. We avoided the global financial crisis would have spiraled down into a Great Depression level event if we followed the same policies that we did in the 1930s. And now it appears that the Fed is kind of maintaining its tight monetary policy until inflation is decisively extinguished. Now, we don't know the answer to that yet, but if you look at some of the statements that Powell's making in his public statements, and if you look at the minutes, you do see language that they reference the fact that they know that one of the big lessons from history is that if you abandon monetary tightening prematurely, you do risk inflation popping up. And when you try to tighten it the second time around, it gets harder. And that was really the mistake of 65 to 82, 1965 to 82.
Yeah, when I read the book, obviously I'm thinking, now when was the period of great monetary stability? It seems that either it was too tight or it was too loose, whether we let the gold market establish that or anybody else. It's an exceptionally difficult thing to do under any circumstance. And that means obviously there are different scales of disequilibrium here, and some of them are very dangerous and some of them not so dangerous. But whether it's the central bank with the flexible exchange rate or even the gold standard, most of the period in this book is periods of disequilibrium. And one can, of course, as an investor in securities, make money from that disequilibrium. So we didn't necessarily knock it.
It's hard, though. It's a skill that is rare, that's for sure. But I was talking to Richard Silla, who I know you know pretty well, last week, and I didn't really think of this at the time. But if you read the book, it is built around crises. It's all the major, not all of them. I hit most of them. The major panics and crashes in U.S. history, and it's easy to lose sight of the fact that a lot of times the financial system actually performs quite well. there are crises every 10 or 15 years, but in the meantime, it actually functions pretty well. And that's something not to lose sight of.
Yeah. And we have in the Library of Stakes on the wall, we've got a lovely chart showing US economic expansion since 1776. Yeah. What is the surprising thing, I think, to most people is how much of the time that is below the line, actually. And those recessions are kind of short, sharp, and painful, but then it returns to growth. But people are usually surprised because this is the emerging market that grows. This is the emerging market that emerges as to just how long America was in recession in the 19th century. It wasn't a bed of expansionary roses. These periods were pretty severe when they did come.
Yeah, and some are more severe than others, and a lot of it has to do with, first of all, how the nature of the speculative event that triggered it. And that's something I talk about in it's called the Great Shadow Bank Run, but it's the global financial crisis. And the events that are most dangerous are looking at that relative to the dot-com, for example. The dot-com bubble was very restricted and to technology stocks, and now everything rose a bit, but it was mainly restricted to speculative technology stocks. The difference between that and the global financial crisis is it didn't really involve the financial system as part of the speculation. The most dangerous types of events are when you have an asset bubble that is, and the financiers that are providing the credit are also involved in it. And that was the global financial crisis. You saw that to a degree in the panic of 1907, definitely in 1929, where the financial system is not only, you know, sort of an enabler, but they're a participant in the crisis. And those are the worst times.
Yeah, it's an one of the things here is obviously the disintermediation of credit. So we have taken a lot of the credit risk off bank balance sheets. So to the extent that that credit risk could fall in the non-banking system, it may not be as difficult as it has been. But I note with interest that that is what people thought had happened in 2007. The idea was that a lot of the credit risk had been sold off highly geared commercial banking, and we're now resting in portfolio investors. But it didn't turn out to be that way, and a lot of that bad credit rebounded back onto the balance sheets. We don't have time to do everything, obviously, in the book, put it mildly. But I think there's something really important that you focus on your bank that I guess most historians would leave out, but I think you're absolutely right to focus on it, which is the change in regulation in the 1930s. Now, most people on Wall Street, as soon as you hear the word regulation, they're probably turning this podcast off. But anyway, I just want to point out that we do have indices for US equities. And in terms of capital gain, not total gain because dividends were high, but in terms of capital gain, by the 1930s, the US stock market really hasn't gone anywhere in 140 odd years. It just hasn't made any progress. Dividends have been reasonable. I think there's a reason for that, and I think one of the key reasons for that is you couldn't trust anything that the management was doing with the cash flow because you had no visibility as to what they were doing with the cash flow. And then if you look at the returns from U.S. equities since 1934, a very high proportion of it has come through capital gain.
I haven't seen that data. I would love to see that data. I mean, I agree with your – I actually haven't seen that data. I'd love to see it. Yeah. It makes sense, though.
Yeah, it's in one of my favorite books in finance, Triumph of the Optimists. You'll find it in a nice.
Yeah, I would love to see that.
And it seems to me that the thing that actually triggered that, and therefore better returns for investors ultimately, was this regulation in the 1930s. Because when we could see what the management was doing with the cash flow, you know, not wasting it on grandiose projects, not stealing it, we could capitalize that. You could capitalize something if you knew what it was, and the market has been capitalizing it ever since. So talk us through the legislation, how it transforms things, and of course, most importantly, how it creates the profession of professional fund management, which really before that, I think if you put the word professional in front of it, I think that would be a bit of a probably mis-selling. So, this is an important bit in history. Fund managers and investors don't like to talk about it, but you rightly talk about it. Tell us how this transformed things.
So The two biggest, well, there are a lot of regulations in the 1930s, but the ones that were most relevant for securities markets were the Securities Act of 1933 and the Securities Exchange Act of 1934. And talking about surprises, it may not have been surprising to you, but it was surprising to me when I started getting into financial history, is before those regulations, first of all, there was a lot of fraud in terms of issuance of securities. And second of all, Wall Street was kind of dominated by stock operators, people that would manipulate the market, that would trade on insider information. And that was really the name of the game. And once that was outlawed with the Securities Exchange Act, and you know, there are regulations to avoid fraud on securities issues with the Securities Act of 1933, you couldn't do that anymore. So that really the only thing that you could do is to try to profit above what you can get from the broad market was to analyze securities. And, you know, to me, it's not a coincidence that Ben Graham wrote his book, Securities Analysis, in 1934, because that was the moment where Ben Graham was what was called a statistician, people kind of in the back room, just kind of collecting data for the brokers and stock operators. And that was a shift in power because securities analysis became the tool for Wall Street going forward. And that really led to there's a whole chapter, well, a part of a chapter on how the securities analysis profession and ultimately the CFA program emerged from those regulations. Oh, the other thing I wanted to say, which is really interesting. So and it's interesting that you mentioned that data because it supports this, is after the Securities Act of 1933 and the Securities Exchange Act of 1934, that actually helped Wall Street because people had confidence and felt safe investing now that the securities were, you know, under regulation. And what was interesting is everyone was surprised when the 1940 Investment Company Act and Investment Advisors Act, was passed. Nobody thought it was going to pass. But the reason that it passed is because investment companies were essentially mutual funds or trusts in the UK, saw that once the Securities Act of 1933 passed, it was easier for companies to raise money because people were more confident that it was regulated. So they wanted to be regulated too. And now what I think is ironic is you fast forward to today, where you see these demands from crypto, from crypto advocates for regulation. And it just reminds me of the investment companies in the 1940s. It's not like they were seeking regulation to change their behavior. They were seeking regulation for credibility and to be able to sell their products. And what's happening with crypto strikes me as a very close parallel with what happened with investment companies in the 1940s.
Let's take the analogy a little bit further. One of the more dramatic and bizarre things that Roosevelt did in this legislation is who he appointed to run the SEC at first instance.
Right.
A man called...
You're not a big fan. You shouldn't be a big fan of him in the UK.
Certainly not a fan of him in the UK. We'll leave that where it is. Joseph Kennedy, but actually stroke of genius putting Joseph Kennedy in charge of this, wasn't it? He wasn't there for very long, but he... It's, you tell us why it worked quite well. Bringing let's be polite and say poacher turned gamekeeper.
Yeah. So he, well, first of all, I don't know if you caught the reference to Pink Floyd, but the momentary lapse of scheming is the title of the little call out. Momentary lapse of reason is the Pink Floyd album. So anyway, I had a little fun with that. But the Joe Kennedy was a stock operator. He was one of the in the 1920s and even in the early 1930s. He was one of these people on Wall Street that would manipulate the market, you know, trade on insider information. So it was very strange that Roosevelt would appoint him to lead the SEC, which was charged with stopping that behavior. But he actually did a really good job because he had very good connections to, you know, to all the people on Wall Street and was able to kind of use a combination of the carrot and the stick to get people signed on. It was almost like getting an insider from Wall Street on the other side, but he was really committed to the SEC's mission of regulating securities markets and bringing integrity, and he believed that that would benefit companies and the United States, which it did, as you mentioned. Now, unfortunately, and this is kind of in the last part, if he had stopped there, it seemed like a great story of reform where you had a former stock operator who did all the shenanigans that were now outlawed, really reform Wall Street, but unfortunately, he was appointed as the ambassador to the UK and kind of definitely ruined his reputation as he, you know, at best kind of ignored what the Nazis were doing, maybe condoned it, and was very defeatist when the British were at their most vulnerable moment, when they're under attack from the Nazis. And this really ruined his reputation. But, you know, if you just kind of take that 1.5 year stint, that I think it was 1.5 years, very short, at the SEC, he actually did a very good job of selling Wall Street that these regulations were to their advantage ultimately, and they were.
Well, I'm going to take two lessons from that. Maybe the SEC should be looking to get a Bitcoin insider to help them with regulation. And number two, never write off the British when they're down. That would be the most important one of all. Mark, it's fantastic. Right. We've only got to the 1930s, and we didn't even cover 1792 to 1932 very well. We kind of skimped. I highly recommend it. Anybody who wants to be interested in financial history starts with this book. This is where you start. This is where you get the roadmap. And from here, you work out where you want to study in more detail. And you've done a great service to the industry. You've done a great service to all of us interested in financial history. I know it's 4 years' work. So can I just say on behalf of, certainly on behalf of me, and I think everybody listening to this podcast, thank you very much for spending 4 years on it, and it'll be in print for many, many, many years to come, I think. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Russell. It's a pleasure talking to somebody. It can be the hardest podcast for people like you because you know a lot of the detail, and sometimes it can be difficult to explain, but I've spent a lot of time in this book to try to write this for people that don't have financial experience or people that do, And it's a privilege to talk to somebody like you. And, you know, I hope the goal with this is to give people resource to make better decisions. And I hope it meets that goal.
Good. I think you've succeeded. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you very much, Russell.
Thanks for listening. The Library of Mistakes is based in Edinburgh. To explore it in person, simply visit libraryofmistakes.com, register as a reader, and book your visit. It's all free. And to enjoy little nuggets from our extensive collection of books, watch videos of our talks, and keep up to date with what we're up to, do follow us on X, LinkedIn, and Instagram. Also, if you'd like to learn more about the world of investment, the Library of Mistakes runs an outstanding course called The Practical History of Financial Markets. To find out more, please see the link in the show notes. And finally, if you enjoyed this episode, why not subscribe to the series? Simply search for Library of Mistakes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or the podcast platform of your choice.